This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. A couple weeks ago, my producer Liam and I took a little field trip to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Hi, Liam.
Hi, Brittany.
We're here.
We're at the Met.
At the Met.
This is my first time here.
This is your first time?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, this is actually such a cool way to see it for the first time. We're coming to see this incredible new exhibition. This new exhibition is called The Harlem Renaissance and Transatlantic Modernism. For those who need a refresher, the Harlem Renaissance was a Black cultural revival that spanned from the 1910s to the 1930s. While it has been examined countless times as a literary movement, celebrating writers like W.E.B. Du Bois, Langston Hughes, and Zora Neale Hurston, this exhibit focuses on the movement's contributions to the visual arts, painting, photography, and sculpture. And this new exhibit was gorgeous and so wide-ranging. Realism, abstraction, explosive scenes of city life.
Wow, look at that.
That's beautiful. And quiet portraits of deep knowing. And the thing about the Harlem Renaissance is, in some ways, it started the debates we're still having about Black art today. Asking big questions like, what is art for? And how do we want to represent ourselves? I sat down with the curator, Denise Morrell, at NPR's office in New York to talk about it. And throughout our conversation, you'll also hear pieces of my journey through the exhibit. Denise, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Well, thank you, Brittany. It's wonderful to be here.
To start, I guess, when we spoke last week, very briefly at the museum, you talked about Harlem as a location, but you said that in this wider movement, it's more like an idea. So what is the idea of Harlem in the Harlem Renaissance?
The idea of Harlem is about Black modernity. It was about the deliberate attempt to remake the image of African Americans as contributors to the unfolding of modern life in American cities. And it was fueled, of course, by the great migration of ultimately millions of African Americans to escape the Jim Crow world of, of the South. It was about Black modernity emanating from Harlem nationwide, but also internationally. So rooted in geographic location, but transcending geography as well.
That brings me to my next thought. You said that the artists and the thinkers of the Harlem Renaissance kind of formalized capital B, capital M, Black modernism. What did you mean by that? Can you define Black modernism and how it was crystallized during that period?
Well, the most clear-cut break is from the kind of rural imagery in which the Black person was invariably subordinate in tattered clothing, in positions of servitude or manual labor as the natural condition of the race. But I would define Black modernity as it was articulated in the period, as urbane city life, where the individual had the social and economic leeway to engage in cultural activities, activities of the mind, the spirit, the imagination. You know, the first full gallery of my exhibition, I show the colorfully dressed couple, stylish, self-confident, the combining of some red gloves with a yellow jacket and a big feather in your hat and that kind of thing, and you're out on a town for the night. But on the other hand, in the same gallery, I show photographs by James Van Der Zee of the hair care salon of Madame C.J. Walker, where she has her stylist. They're very elegant, and she has afternoon tea, so he gets a photograph of, you know, the salon stylist having tea.
I mean, salon barely does this justice, the space that they're in.
It's very fancy. Very, very fancy.
Very, very fancy. But geez, oh, Pete, yeah, I mean, there's like drapery, there's molding. Everyone's wearing stockings and holding a porcelain teacup.
We have almost an entire wall of card player paintings depicting what Rick Powell, the esteemed scholar, calls the boys in the back room.
Oh, okay? Yes, playing cards.
They're playing cards.
Various
they're in the pool hall.
and
you know, they're cracking jokes.
Very, like, bright colors. Very electric blue. These, like, men
uh-huh.
sitting around a table smoking.
Cigars.
Conspiratorial
drinking.
Air.
Yes.
These spaces of black male sociability. There's no attempt to single any one of them out as the sole representation of black creativity, black modernity, black excellence.
On this point of black modernity, you mentioned in the essay that you have in the book mm-hmm. for this exhibition that, like, a lot of the ways that black people think about our art and ourselves now mm-hmm. is based out of the Harlem Renaissance and that modernity. Can you kind of expand on that?
Well, I think it was the idea that we were going to define by ourselves, for ourselves, what our public image was. Just the idea of depicting aspects of everyday life, people from all social roles, mm-hmm. not just the so-called good Negro. They were saying, we want to include the common run of us, the term that Zora Neale Hurston used, people with their colorful clothes and energetic dancing were creating new modes of expression emanating from African American culture that we should embrace rather than reject. Mm-hmm. You don't see the leading portraitist of the day only depicting, say, you know, upper class or bourgeois types. They portray whatever subject interests them. Langston Hughes said, we know we're beautiful, but ugly too. So the duality, the complexity of human nature was not something to be papered over or dismissed. We could be fully credible as human beings, even as we reveal the complexities and the dualities and the contradictions. And I think that that complexity is part of the creative expression of the leading black writers and thinkers today.
So interesting. It's like some of the things that you described, it sounds like there are these century-old reverberations of some of the ideas that you're unpacking here. Even I think about Zora Neale Hurston, mm-hmm. who, as somebody who was a part of the Federal Writers Project, the mm-hmm. WPA, was traveling around the country and mm-hmm. and collecting stories from black people all across the South, especially in Florida. And her wanting to embrace the folk ways of everyday people, to me that feels very connected to like the birth of hip-hop or something like that.
It emanates from the street, so to speak, or the neighborhood mm-hmm. or the everyday person. We don't have to demonstrate that we are the most educated, the most elevated by standards that were not set by us. We can set our own standards of excellence, our own standards of what is vibrant creative expression, and we can work in those modes.
To that point, one thing that I noticed kind of floating around in the ether back then, but I also see now, is what art is for, especially black art. What is it for? I see that debated upon all the time today, I feel like. Is that something that you're seeing?
Well, I mean, that question of what art is for is certainly something that was debated during the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah.
And you had, on the one hand, Alain Locke, the author of the book The New Negro in 1925. It laid out the founding philosophy of the movement. He was art for the sake of creativity. What are the most original, innovative ways to depict the black physiognomy, to visualize black values, black aspiration, to just put forth a creative vision. So that's aesthetics. That's kind of Alain Locke. But then you have a W.E.B. Du Bois, who was the editor of the Crisis magazine at the time, the NAACP monthly magazine. He gave many artists their first start by commissioning them for illustrations on the cover. But he also said, you know, I don't give a damn about art that is not propaganda. We have had propaganda directed at us to subordinate us and to elevate other cultures. So I want to see art that elevates our culture too.
Like kind of programming.
Exactly, exactly. So you have that kind of art to represent aspiration, almost civic and activist role, as opposed to art for the sake of creative expression. And that's a discussion that has reverberated over the generations.
There were other works that were in the exhibition, to your point, that almost seemed to question if art actually had to be, quote unquote, about, and I put that in air quotes, like about anything, if it could just be representational of something that's just very beautiful or that, that the painter finds beautiful. There was an entire section on still life. And one painting that stood out to me and also our producer, Liam, when we were there was this painting by Louis Milou Jones.
Yes.
Of a head of cauliflower and a slice of pumpkin.
Cauliflower and pumpkin. Look at that. Oh, I love this still life. It's like, I wouldn't necessarily say art for art's sake, but just the idea that someone could be like, I'm going to paint some cauliflower and pumpkin. Yeah, why not?
It seemed like the point of that painting was just simply to be beautiful.
Right. And then on the other hand, many of the artists insisted on making still lifes and landscapes that did not depict the Black body, just to assert their independence from always having to represent the Black body. So, you know, many of the great portraitists, including William H. Johnson and Laura Wheeler Waring, and to some extent, Aaron Douglas, in addition to making their figural works, portraiture, history paintings, and so forth, they made landscapes and still lives and spent sometimes years making just that in the name of artistic freedom. I'm not going to be dictated to. I'm not going to be told what kind of art I have to make.
Coming up, what the portraits of the Harlem Renaissance reveal and why Denise wanted to revisit this period right now. Stick around.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Here's a familiar situation. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy.
The portraiture is something that has really stuck with me throughout this entire exhibit. At one point in the exhibit, you walk into a room, every single wall, wall to wall, portraits on portraits on portraits.
Right.
And each of the subjects and most, if not all, of the painters, I think, were featured were Black.
Yes.
And my producer, Liam, and I noticed something.
What's so interesting about a lot of this portraiture is that, like, each subject feels confident or at ease across the board. When taken in aggregate, it feels like each of the Black people in these portraits felt some level of comfort with the person who was painting them.
I was going to, like, say that, too. Like, there's something about the gaze where it looks like they are also observing the viewer.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it feels like a conspiratorial tone there where they're kind of like, I'm in on the portrait, too.
You know, as much as they were being gazed upon, they were staring right back at the viewer.
Absolutely.
I mean, what was the thinking behind that section about the portraiture of the Harlem Renaissance?
Yes. Well, one of the thoughts that I really pull from is W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folks, when he talks about the double consciousness as the sense of always contemplating oneself, gazing at oneself, thinking about how do I want to present myself to the world, and wanting to have the maximum freedom to do that, but also being aware of this external gaze, you know, the gaze of white and other factors that would seek to limit the very freedom that you're trying to seize. And I think that is why so many of the artists depicted the subjects as either directly looking back at the viewer from a stance of self-confidence, of whatever happens in this transaction, I'm going to be able to shape what it means for me.
I want to switch gears for a second. Historian Henry Louis Gates Jr. says that the Harlem Renaissance was surely as gay as it was black, but it wasn't exclusively either of those things.
Right.
You know, even ballroom culture has its roots in the Harlem drag balls of the time. Many of the architects of the movement held both of these identities, gay and black. It's inextricable. And it's very interesting to me that this examination or re-examination of blackness within the Harlem Renaissance is happening in tandem with renegotiating ideas around gender and sexuality.
Yes.
Those things are happening at the same time.
Yes.
How did the leaders of the Harlem Renaissance see blackness and queerness as tied together back then?
Yes. And the answer is there was no monolithic view. The more conservative leaders, the ones who would be the one to talk about the talented 10th or the good Negro or whatever, definitely did not see queer identity as having any part in this at all. Mm. And that was reflective of the broader culture. But on the other hand, there were artists who, to varying degrees of openness, embraced their identity in the artwork they made. So we have a wonderful painting by Beaufort Delaney, who became a permanent expat in living and working in France. Mm-hmm. And he met James Baldwin
and made this portrait.
It may be the only. It's a very rare portrait of a male nude. Nudity was rare in the Harlem Renaissance period just because of the history of the exploitation of the black female body.
Right.
But we have this nude by a gay artist depicting his gay friend, and they were friends for decades.
Oh, is this a James Baldwin portrait? Look at all the colors. Like, his eyebrows are pink.
Yeah, the eyebrows. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, there's so much. There's, like, little pops of yellow.
Green,
these, like,
yeah.
This really bright kind of, like, neon coral kind of pop on his thigh.
It's just, it has so much joy in it and so much love. Oh, the last sentence of the plaque reads, "Both introspective and joyous, Dark Rapture stands as a visual manifestation of queer camaraderie, identity, and the search for belonging."
The Met lasted an exhibit on Harlem in the 1960s, 1969, which didn't have very many black artists in it. Talk to me about that. And what's the correction being made here?
I don't like to think of my exhibition. Well, okay, I understand it can be seen as a correction, but I didn't develop to be a correction. And in fact, my desire to do an exhibition was more about my very firm belief that this period has been marginalized in art history and it needs to regain the central place it actually had. But still, being at the Met, Harlem on My Mind, the exhibition in 1969, which was a sort of a photographic montage, not unlike what you would see in a museum of history or natural history. It did have one Harlem artist, the photographer James Van Der Zee. The Harlem on My Mind show did not include any painters, no paintings, no sculpture, no representation of black artistic work that was other than the Van Der Zee photographs. Artists objected and picketed the Met for a long time, and that was a running news story for most of the time the exhibition was on view. So I think the show is all of the art that should have been in the 1969 show that was not.
Mm. It's been about a century since the Harlem Renaissance. Why is this exhibit important now?
You know, there is this sense of what does it mean to be American? Who's American? And I think there is this sense of this golden past of white hegemony, no black presence artistically, economically, or otherwise. Mm. And this show just blows that out of the water because it shows that there was a very major black presence. Artistically, there was a rise and expansion of a black middle and upper middle class. It really was the moment when we began to act in the world in a way that is similar to the way we go through life today.
Hmm.
That's, I think, the enduring aspect of it.
Denise, thank you so much. It was
a
pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Brittany. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks again to Denise Morrell. The Harlem Renaissance and Transatlantic Modernism is showing now at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Liam McBain.
This episode was edited by
Jessica Plachek.
Engineering support came from
Sina Lafredo.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways to opt outside.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
When voters talk during an election season, we listen. We ask questions, we follow up, and we bring you along to hear what we learned. Get closer to the issues, the people, and your vote at the NPR Elections Hub. Visit npr.org/elections.